is a lawsuit that Dawn has brought in its own capacity, and Khadija Cengiz, Jamal's widow, is our co-plaintiff. We are jointly together in this lawsuit for the murder and torture of Jamal Khashoggi. And we know that Mohammed bin Salman has demanded that the Biden administration interfere in our lawsuit to grant him immunity. That's not going to happen. It hasn't happened so far. But if he ascends to become king, he will have sovereign immunity. The other defendants in the lawsuit will remain, and we are waiting for a verdict from the court on their motion to dismiss our lawsuit. We intend to prevail. We hope we will prevail. I should note that today we will be commemorating the murder of Jamal Khashoggi by Mohammed bin Salman by unveiling a new street sign in front of the Saudi embassy at 1 p.m. That I think is the most important act of commemoration and accountability that exists to date, a permanent street sign in front of the Saudi embassy, reminding them and reminding the whole world who was responsible for this heinous crime. Very happy to see a truce in Yemen, but let's face it, this is a face-saving exit for the Saudi government from their catastrophic, futile war that has caused nothing but destruction and brought zero gain, even for the Saudis' nefarious plot to contain and control Yemen.
So the Saudi Arabian embassy will be on Jamal Khashoggi Way?
That's right. The new address of the Saudi embassy, and we hope Google will adjust its maps to reflect that, is officially now Jamal Khashoggi Way. That is designated by the Washington, D.C. City Council, which unanimously approved
3 seconds.
Our efforts to redesignate the street. And we hope you all watch the unveiling of the street sign today at 1 p.m.
Sarah Lee Whitson, we want to thank you for being with us of Dawn. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland voters will have a chance to change their city government this fall, Portland Public Schools ban guns from school campuses, and a new ACLU report details the true extent of unpaid prison labor. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 15th, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. Portland voters will have an exciting measure on the ballot this November, the opportunity to change the structure of their city government. Three changes will be up for voters to consider. The first of these changes would be to implement ranked choice voting in city elections. If passed, voters would get to number their preference of candidates on their ballot instead of just voting for one person. The first choice votes will be added up, and if there isn't a majority behind one candidate, the candidate with the lowest first choice votes is eliminated, and everyone who voted for them as their first choice has their ballot recounted and their vote applied to their second choice pick. Ranked choice voting is considered a more representative way to add up votes since it prevents someone from winning that doesn't have the support of a majority of voters. The second change that will be on the ballot is the creation of geographic districts. Currently, city commissioners, the mayor, and the city auditor are elected in citywide elections. If approved, the measure would create 4 geographic districts that would have 3 city councilors elected from each. Candidates would have to live in their district and be elected by people from that district only. The third change would be to Portland's style of government. Portland is the only major American city with a commission form of government. The recommended changes would increase the number of city councilors from 5 to 12. It would limit their responsibilities to just creating legislation, not running city bureaus like city commissioners do now. It would also take the mayor off the city council and hire a city administrator. Those two roles together, the mayor and the city administrator, would be tasked with carrying out the policy created by the council and administrating the city bureaus. Every 10 years, the Portland Charter Commission is called to evaluate the city charter and refer potential changes to the voters. The volunteer Portland Charter Commission voted Tuesday evening to put the changes on the November ballot, 17-3. All Portland City Commissioners and the mayor have expressed support for moving away from the current form of government. Commission-style governments were really popular in the early 1900s in the United States, but most were changed or dismantled in the 1950s and 60s. Importantly, citywide elections and commission-style governments have been found to create systemic underrepresentation for marginalized communities. This isn't the first time Portlanders have been given the option to change their form of government since it was adopted in 1913. 7 times some version of this change has been on the ballot, and 7 times it's been rejected. That said, recent polling by FM3 Research found that Portlanders find the idea of ranked choice voting broadly appealing, and that 4 out of 5 residents thought the city government wasn't serving people well. The Portland Public School Board has voted to ban guns from school campuses. With more, it's KBOO's Josh Salem.
The Portland Public Schools Board voted last night to restrict individuals with concealed firearms licenses from carrying guns on school property. Oregon Senate Bill 554 previously gave schools the ability to prohibit concealed carry weapons on their property. However, an Oregon Public Broadcasting analysis in May reported only about 13% of public school districts in Oregon had passed a ban. The recent school shooting in Uvalde, Texas, furthered safety concerns. Comments from the community and the PPS superintendent showed strong support for the resolution ahead of its passing. A memo from Superintendent Guadalupe Guerrero to the board was aimed at making the point that the presence of guns in schools does not make teachers, students, or staff safer. It outlined the district's current safety efforts. Of the 5 shared public comments related to the policy, 4 were in support of the board approving the revisions. Messages of support came from local chapters of Moms Demand Action and Students Demand Action, Our Children Oregon, and the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners. The one comment in opposition to the revisions came from Rob Reynolds, Republican candidate for Oregon House District 41. Reynolds said, quote, "From the constituents in my district, have you thought about the real safety to them? It doesn't seem like with this resolution that you have," end quote. Parents asked the school district to move forward in adopting other relevant policies, like educating parents on the proper storage of firearms and considering threat assessment teams. The revisions to the weapons policy were approved unanimously. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
As the country continues to reel from mass shootings in Buffalo, Uvalde, and elsewhere, national law enforcement groups are calling on the U.S. Senate to address the nation's gun violence crisis. Nadia Ramlagan has more in Kentucky.
National law enforcement groups are joining the chorus of Kentuckians calling on the U.S. Senate to pass meaningful gun safety measures. A bipartisan group of senators is working on specific legislation after announcing an agreement to support red flag laws, boost background checks, and increase mental health resources. Kentucky Republican Senator Mitch McConnell said Tuesday he'd support a bill that follows the agreement. Kim Craven with the National Association of Women Law Enforcement Executives says her group has been advocating for measures that prevent people with a history of violence or domestic abuse from getting firearms.
We have a lot of research at our fingertips that we can reflect on and come together and create programs and strategies to reduce the number of gun deaths that are occurring across our nation.
Last week, U.S. House lawmakers passed the Protecting Our Kids Act to raise the age to buy semi-automatic rifles from 18 to 21 and create federal laws against gun trafficking, amid other reforms. Only one Kentucky representative, Democrat John Yarmuth of Louisville, voted to approve the bill. In 2020, the Commonwealth had the 13th highest gun death rate in the country, according to the Giffords Law Center. Craven points out that several states have struck a balance between responsible gun ownership and policies like implementing universal background checks and closing private sale loopholes.
If we look at some of the states that have the strictest gun laws, and when they combine that with programming, they are among the lowest states that are having gun violence.
Frederick Thomas is president of the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives. He says for those who choose to serve their communities by becoming a police officer, this is a moral issue.
I can't ignore the underserved communities who see loved ones transform into victims in the blink of an eye. I can't ignore the fact that federal inactions has led us to this horrific infection point.
Mass shootings have occurred every day in June, except one, across Kentucky and more than a dozen other states, according to the Gun Violence Archive. This is Nadia Ramlagan for Kentucky News Connection.
Senator Mitch McConnell says he supports the bipartisan gun safety legislation, and Senator Chuck Schumer says he will bring it to a vote before July 4th. With more, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
For myself, I'm comfortable with the framework, and if the legislation ends up reflecting what the framework indicates, I'll be supportive.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says he supports a bipartisan gun safety framework and will likely vote for legislation that reflects it. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said in a news conference he plans to pass a bill before the July 4th recess.
The agreement was something many believed was not possible just a few weeks ago, but Democrats and a good number of Republicans said we'd have to try.
A gunman opened fire inside a building where more than 250 children and staff were starting summer camp in Duncanville, Texas, Monday. Officers shot and killed the attacker. Kim Craven with the National Association of Women Law Enforcement Executives says her organization has been advocating for stricter background checks and measures to prevent people with a history of domestic abuse or other types of violence from accessing firearms.
We have a lot of research at our fingertips that we can reflect on and come together and create programs and strategies to reduce the number of gun deaths that are occurring across our nation.
Ohio Governor Mike DeWine signed a bill this week allowing Ohio school districts to arm employees with guns. Meanwhile, the House passed a bill Tuesday to provide around-the-clock security protections to family members of Supreme Court justices, sending the measure to President Biden's desk. At a union convention in Philadelphia Tuesday, President Biden talked about his administration's plan for the economy, addressed record high inflation, and contrasted his economic plans with Republican proposals.
Wall Street didn't build this country. The middle class built this country, and unions built the middle class.
The president will visit Saudi Arabia in July, including a meeting with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The announcement drew scrutiny from human rights advocates. Poor People's Campaign co-chair Reverend William Barber says his June 18th Moral March on Washington will put the spotlight on poverty and the plight of low-wage workers.
Billionaires made $2 trillion during the pandemic while 8 million more people fell into poverty.
The January 6th committee postponed its Wednesday hearing, slated to review former President Trump's efforts to pressure the Justice Department to investigate his unfounded claims of election fraud. Trump released a written rebuttal to the committee's testimony and evidence, accusing Democrats of seeking to distract the public from serious domestic issues facing the country. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Researchers are debunking a false narrative that a youth violence movement is sweeping the country. Data shows a drop in youth crime over the past 20 years. Mary Sherman has more in Ohio.
New research suggests that reports of skyrocketing youth crime are not only unfounded, but also fueling calls for stricter punishments. Data from the Sentencing Project shows the share of crimes in the U.S. committed by young people fell by more than half in the past 2 decades. It also decreased in all major types of offenses in 2020. Given the stress young people faced over the past 2 years, report author Richard Mendel says he wouldn't be surprised if future data reveals a pandemic-era increase in youth crime, but he contends that a temporary rise shouldn't be used to justify returning to get-tough approaches.
This is not a moment to be panicking about youth crime, especially if that panic is going to lead us to embrace solutions that we know the evidence shows does not work.
According to the report, juvenile detention and transfers to adult court can worsen youth outcomes. Instead, Mendel encourages reforms that help drive young people away from delinquency. These include reducing reliance on youth confinement and making stronger investments in social and mental health supports in schools and communities. Mendel says Ohio is a national model for reducing youth incarceration through Reclaim Ohio, which offers financial incentives for counties to divert young people from Ohio Department of Youth Services institutions to community-based programs.
research on that is overwhelmingly positive, that the kids do much better in terms of rearrest, in terms of reincarceration in the community programs than they do in incarceration, and yet that program has come under attack.
A commission is reviewing the program's past 3 years after learning that the suspect in the shooting death of a Cleveland police officer was on juvenile court probation. The youth services population dropped from a high of over 2,600 in May 1992 to 375 in December of 2020, which officials attribute to Reclaim Ohio's success. Meanwhile, officials in Cuyahoga County and Columbus have reported recent increases in stolen cars and carjackings among younger juveniles. But Mendel believes media coverage of youth crime is often sensationalized and missing critical context.
There's a lot of political opportunism that's being applied. It's important to be skeptical and to look for context and look at the historical data. Is it really true?
The report notes because there is no published federal data on carjackings, increases in a select number of cities don't necessarily indicate a national trend. For Ohio News Connection, I'm Mary Sherman.
According to a new report from the American Civil Liberties Union, prisoners in the U.S. produce at least $11 billion in goods and services annually, but receive just pennies an hour in wages for their prison jobs. The U.S. imprisons a higher percentage of its population than any other country in the world, and two-thirds of them, around 800,000 people, have jobs. More than 80% of incarcerated laborers do general prison maintenance, including cleaning, cooking, repair work, laundry, and other essential services. For non-maintenance jobs, workers earn an average of 13 to 52 cents an hour, while in seven states, including Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Mississippi, South Carolina, and Texas, in those states, the vast majority of prison workers are paid nothing. The ACLU report states, incarcerated workers who are paid often see most of their pay withheld for, quote, taxes, room and board expenses, and court costs. More than 75% of working prisoners reported that if they can't work or decline to do so, they're subject to punishment ranging from solitary confinement to the loss of family visits to denial of sentence reductions. Jennifer Turner is the principal author of the report. Turner said, quote, state governments and the prison system are extracting tremendous value from a captive and exploited workforce, all while claiming they can't afford to pay them a livable wage. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a special rebroadcast of our interview with Street Roots investigative reporter Piper McDaniel about the housing crisis in Oregon and how more housing alone isn't enough to fix the problem. Then, at 5:45, stick around for news from the Boo, your look at the news inside KBOO. Tonight, we'll hear about the planning process for KBOO's Cuba trip. At 6, it's Rural Roots Rising. Then at 7, it's Culture in Motion with Mike Crenshaw. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 56 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with some peaks of sunshine and a daytime high of 70. Today in history, in 1921, Bessie Coleman earns her pilot's license, becoming the first African-American woman and Native American to hold a pilot's license. She then became a famous pilot in notoriously dangerous air shows, going by Queen Bess or Brave Bessie. The quote of the day is from American rapper and musician Ice Cube, who was born today in 1969. He said, quote, truth is the ultimate power. When truth comes around, all lies have to run and hide. The Federal Reserve announced a 3/4 percentage point increase in interest rates in response to rampant inflation in the U.S. and concerns about recession. It's the largest interest rate hike since 1994. The benchmark federal funds rate will rise to between 1.5% and 1.75%, and officials say they expected rates to rise to at least 3% this year. The Federal Reserve statement warned that, quote, inflation remains elevated because of world events having impact on supply chains and prices. The Fed specifically cited Russia's invasion of Ukraine and China's COVID-related lockdowns. Many are concerned about the U.S. falling into a recession. Experts look to indicators like the fact that retail spending in the U.S. fell for the first time this year in May, and that home sales have fallen for 3 consecutive months due to rising interest rates. Add on to that, consumer confidence hit a record low between May and June. While unemployment is at a near half-century low, the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta said today that it expects 0% economic growth for the second quarter. As electric cars gain popularity, states will need to make up for lost gas tax revenue. Oregon already offers drivers the option for a pay-per-mile charge instead of a gas tax. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. States use revenue from gas taxes to help pay for road and bridge maintenance, but electric vehicles do not use gas. So as hybrid cars and EVs become more popular, states may find themselves short on funds.
When we get to a certain level, no doubt it's going to be impacting our revenue and start constraining our ability to maintain our roads and bridges.
That's Michelle Godfrey of the Oregon Department of Transportation. Her state is one of many that is exploring solutions.
Every state in the nation is experiencing the same problem. It's universal.
Since 2015, Oregon has offered drivers the option of paying a per-mile charge, called a road usage charge, instead of a gas tax. Participants receive a device that plugs into their car and tracks how far they drive. Then they pay 1.9 cents per mile and receive a credit for any gas tax they've paid.
It's all seamless to the driver. It's all electronic and wireless.
The program is currently voluntary, but as gas consumption declines, states will need to find new ways to fund road and bridge maintenance.
And we think that the road usage charge program, as we've designed it, meets that need.
So it could lay the groundwork for legislation in Oregon and beyond. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Over 100 million Americans, more than a third of the country, have been warned to stay indoors because of the heat and humidity. The potentially lethal heat wave stretches from parts of the Gulf Coast to the Great Lakes and east to the Atlantic. Plus, there's been record heat in the Southwest, with Las Vegas reaching 109, while Phoenix reached 110 for 4 days in a row, with nighttime temperatures never going below 80. Matt Bewitcher is a National Weather Service meteorologist in St. Louis. He told CNN, quote, "This is a day where not only folks who are susceptible to heat-related illnesses, but really just about anybody that's going to be outside for an extended period of time is at risk for heat-related illnesses." Increased heat also means increased wildfires, with 2.5 million acres having burned in the U.S. this year so far, more than double for all of 2021. A mountain in Yellowstone National Park will be renamed to honor Native Americans. With that story and more, it's Megan Kamrick with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick in for Antonio Gonzalez. The National Park Service is renaming one of Yellowstone National Park's largest mountains to honor Native Americans. Parks officials say the original name is an affront to indigenous people. The new name reflects recommendations from the Rocky Mountain Tribal Council. Taylor Stagner from Yellowstone Public Radio reports.
Yellowstone National Park changed Mount Doan's name to First Peoples Mountain. The mountain is located to the east of Yellowstone Lake, and settlers named the mountain after Gustave Doan, who has been cited as instrumental in the conquest of the area. According to a Yellowstone National Park press release, Doan led an attack in 1870 against a band of Piegan Blackfeet and killed 173 indigenous people, including elders and children suffering from smallpox. The event is called Maria's Massacre, and Doan boasted about that attack for the rest of his life. Tribes have been calling for the renaming of the mountain for many years. 2 years after the massacre, Yellowstone was named the first national park. For National Native News, I'm Taylor Stagner.
Members of a Native American Methodist church in Oklahoma said the congregation has been targeted numerous times by intruders who inflicted thousands of dollars of damages. KCCO-TV reports officials with the church, located in Norman, thought the suspects were looking for money. Instead, they left $10,000 worth of damages and stole candy and chips and drove a butcher knife into a table. Reverend Justine Wilson said she thinks that was a message, and many parishioners don't feel comfortable coming back to the church until the suspects were caught. The church had been raising money for a new sanctuary, but that will now go towards repairing the damage. Authorities in Brazil on Tuesday said they arrested a second man in connection with the disappearance of an indigenous expert and a British journalist. The New York Times reports officials were shifting from a search and rescue operation to a homicide investigation. Police say they arrested the brother of a fisherman who was detained last week. Journalist Dom Phillips was reporting on patrol teams that indigenous advocate Bruno Pereira helped create to tackle illegal hunting and fishing in the area, work that led to threats against Pereira. Reuters reports the two were in a remote area that has the world's largest number of uncontacted indigenous people and has become a center for drug smugglers, illegal logging, and mining. A Senate committee later this week will hold a listening session called Cannabis in Indian Country. Marijuana Moment reports the Senate Indian Affairs Committee will meet on June 17th. Chairman Brian Schatz, a Democrat from Hawaii, said it's an opportunity for tribes to offer feedback to Senate staffers on cannabis issues. In March, nine senators sent a letter to U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland urging him to direct federal prosecutors to not interfere with tribes that pursue cannabis legalization policies. The Department of Justice used to follow a guidance from the Obama administration that embodied that kind of prosecutorial discretion, but that was rescinded by former Attorney General Jeff Sessions, along with another memo that sought to curtail prosecutions in states with legal cannabis markets. The senators are urging Garland to reinstate that prosecutorial discretion. And a former tribal vice chairman and tribal council speaker for the Navajo Nation has died. The Farmington Daily Times reports Edward T. Begay died on June 12th. He was 87. Begay helped secure the first gaming compact with the state of New Mexico. He also led a delegation to the United Nations to advocate for the recognition of the human rights of the Navajo people. Navajo council member Amber Knazbaugh Crotty said, quote, "Many of us are here because we were able to hear his words in fighting for our people and making decisions that are in the best interest." For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
A new report finds that hundreds of rural hospitals may be forced to reduce services or even close without support from Congress or the Biden administration. Suzanne Potter has more on the funding crisis in Nevada.
Rural hospitals across the country and in Nevada will be in dire economic straits once the COVID funding runs out, according to a new report. Researchers at the Bipartisan Policy Center found that 441 rural hospitals have multiple financial risk factors. Report co-author Julia Harris says 116 hospitals closed between 2010 and 2019, and then the pace slowed during COVID.
So the CARES Act and the American Rescue Plan really did a lot to stave off more hospitals from closing. But that aid masks the fact that the underlying finances of rural hospitals continue to deteriorate, especially with new pressures brought on from the pandemic.
All hospitals, but rural hospitals especially, have been hard hit during COVID with huge staff shortages and supply chain issues that drive up the price of goods they must purchase. And of course, hospitals with a low volume of patients generally receive less funding. According to an analysis from Becker's Hospital Report in March, six of Nevada's 13 rural hospitals are at risk of closing. Joan Hall, president of Nevada Rural Hospital Partners, says some are considering joining a new federal program that would allow them to pare down their services but keep the ER.
Some hospitals would not have inpatient services available. So they would have an emergency room and outpatient services, diagnostic lab imaging, but perhaps you wouldn't be able to stay in the hospital if you needed. You'd have to be transferred.
The report recommends that the administration and Congress hold off on scheduled budget cuts, make higher Medicaid payments permanent, and keep flexibility in telehealth until 2 years after the public health emergency ends. Meanwhile, the state is collaborating with UNR and UNLV to train or recruit more medical professionals, especially nurses and respiratory therapists. For Nevada News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael thinks it's June 21st.
So much rain, the plants are ecstatic with growth and the promise of berries and fruit. Drought in California, over 100 degrees in several states, but not here. No disasters, no mass shootings, over 100 days of Ukraine and no one's watching. You can fly into America without a COVID test. Clackamas County finished counting votes in under a month and no more elections till November. Congress and the Senate are on summer vacation. Be joyous and careful out there. Don't drown, don't burn, don't drive drunk. Go to the beach, the mountains, bike around town, or just hang out outside. Put the flannel away. Get screens in the windows. Talk to neighbors, old and new. Yeah, the drizzle will be back in a day or two, but summer officially begins next week. Why wait? For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 15th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Dan Raphael. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Nadia Romlagon, Suzanne Potter, Mary Sherman, Megan Kamrick, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth and stick around at 5:45 for news from the BOO. Thanks for listening.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Today, I'm speaking with Piper McDaniel, an investigative reporter at Street Roots, about her new article published June 1st. It's titled, "From Here on Out, Rents Will Only Rise and Rise and Rise. Building More Homes Won't